Hello, everybody. I'm Radio Johnny, and welcome to another Recovery Radio broadcast recorded live in the basement of the Latah Recovery Center, which is somewhere west of the Continental Divide. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Latah Recovery Center, which is located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at latahrecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at latahrecoverycenter.org and on Facebook. Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how addiction and behavioral health disorders affect us all, and to share the recovery resources available in our area, along with the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experience, insight, and hope for continuing recovery. And like I said earlier, I am Radio Johnny, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And we're going to skip over the January calendar just now because it's not quite posted on the LRC website yet, but you should be able to pick that up in the coming days. There is one great announcement I want to share with you right now, and it's about the New Year's Eve extravaganza, which will be hosted by the Moscow Friday Night group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's co-sponsored by Three Forks, a group out of Pullman, Washington. So help us bring in the new year with food, fellowship, and fun. Treat us with your favorite dish, your funnest board game, or just bring your sparkling face. It's going to be on Saturday, December 31st, of course, New Year's Eve. It's going to start at 5 p.m. and go till midnight. It's going to be at St. Mark's Episcopal Church, which is at 111 South Jefferson Street in Moscow. It's right across the street from the Moscow Library. And the potluck will begin at 5:30. And the open hybrid speaker meeting, Medley, starts at 7 p.m. This is friends and family welcome. It's an open meeting. Our speakers are going to be Trish, Max, and Gino. And you can go to the aadistrict22.org website, and you can pick up the Zoom link there, along with meeting ID, passcode, blah, blah, blah. And you can sign up to bring food or to be of service for the group. And again, this is family-friendly recovery. It's fun, games, food. We're all looking forward to having a great time there. Again, 5 p.m. to midnight, St. Mark's Episcopal Church here in Moscow, 111 South Jefferson Street, right across from the library. And today, I want to do a couple of things. One, I'm going to read some stories from the back of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, our big blue book that we use in the program. But before that, I want to go over some helpful hints, I guess, suggestions for people who are trying to stay sober through New Year's Eve and, you know, all holidays in general. Then go on to the stories after that. Now, it's been my experience that early in recovery, when we encounter these, you know, what I used to call high holy days of drinking, where everyone's drinking, so, you know, my addiction wouldn't really stand out as much as it would normally, because I didn't drink normally, of course. But the way I handled it when going to these occasions was kind of a multi-prong approach. First and foremost, I had to really think about, do I really need to go to this event? You know, whether it's a family deal or a work party or just a social event with friends where I knew there would be drinking. And it's kind of a struggle at first because I really had to think about, do I really just want to put myself in that environment? And some of the time the answer was no, especially if I knew the group I would be going to hang out with were heavy drinkers, and you know, it was going to get loud and rowdy. I just didn't want to be in that situation, so I would, you know, make a minor excuse. I have to work the next day, or I'm already promised to go to something with family, or do something with my wife, or with another friend, something like that. It's a small lie, but to protect your sobriety, I think it's probably okay. Another thing to do is, if you do feel like you're okay, and you can go to the event, and you don't feel like your sobriety is going to be threatened, quite often what will happen is the first thing you walk in the door, if there's a host, they'll greet you and offer to get you something to drink. My thing to do would be to say there's they have a bar there. I would say, hey, just show me to the bar and I'll fix myself something. And I'd go and get a glass and put some, you know, Diet Cola in there and walk around with that glass in my hand. That almost 99% of the time eliminates anybody coming up and quote, pushing a drink on you. Or, you know, if you need a refill, oh yeah, let me go grab it. I have a special cocktail I make for myself. Or you can always just ask for water or something else. And if it goes beyond that and you're starting to get uncomfortable, like, whoa, why aren't you drinking? You can always say something like, yeah, I have to work tomorrow, or I've got something I've got to do later, or I have to drive, so I really don't want to drink. At any rate, I've found that 90% of the time, especially if it's people that are close to me, they probably know that I'm not drinking right now or trying to avoid it. And if they don't, usually they'll leave you alone after, you know, the first couple of times. Now, another good idea is, if you know you're going to be at a place where there's a lot of drinking or whatever going on, is have an escape plan. It's always a good idea. Drive yourself. If you don't drive yourself, go with a sober friend who is driving. And then if things get a little too hectic, you know, find your host. Wish him a good night. Again, small white lie, I have to get up for work, whatever. And just head on down the road. I have found that usually when parties get loud and slightly obnoxious, people don't even know that you're gone anyway, but that's just my experience. So have a plan. And, you know, you can also, if things are getting weird, you can also get on the phone and call a trusted friend, you know, your accountability partner, your sponsor, someone like that. There's always somebody available on the phone to talk to and, you know, help you make a good choice, help you make a healthy choice for you. Because for me, nothing is more important than my sobriety. And if I'm going to be in a tough situation, I always have backup somewhere there. So there's a few ideas, some things you can think of do. You could also, of course, go to a sober celebration like the New Year's Eve extravaganza that'll be happening this coming Saturday night at 5:30 at St. Mark's Episcopal Church. And I'll keep reminding of you that. You know, it's going to go to midnight, bring a game, have fun, listen to the speakers. Bring the family. Kids, absolutely. They'll have a great time. We usually have a good crowd, lots of kids, kids games, things for them to do, so it should be fun. Okay, and I'm going to open the book here, and we will start with a couple of stories from the back and see where we go from there. And this is story number 10 in the back of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And the title is Tightrope. Trying to navigate separate worlds was a lonely charade that ended when this gay alcoholic finally landed in AA. Drinking was always a part of my family background. All the men in my family drank. My father, and later my brothers, were heavy drinkers. As long as a person held down a job, didn't embarrass his family or friends too frequently, and kept out of trouble, he was entitled to get drunk on a regular basis. Drinking was an adult thing to do, a part of growing up. I don't believe it ever crossed my mind that I shouldn't drink. I was raised in a conservative religion, and I commuted to religious schools some distance from home. Because I had a quick mind and was comfortable with academics, I became something of a teacher's pet. As a result, I was a serious, shy, somewhat bookish child, and a teenager who found it difficult to relate to my peers. So when I went away to college, I was an alcoholic waiting to happen. My relation to alcohol was a love affair from the very beginning. Although I wasn't too thrilled with the taste, I loved the effects. Alcohol helped me to hide my fears. The ability to converse was an almost miraculous gift to a shy and lonely individual. It was at this time that I also began to struggle with the question of my sexuality. For me, the idea of being homosexual, the word gay, wasn't then in common use, was unthinkable. Drinking helped me to forget and evade. Also, it provided some cover. When you are drunk, people are not surprised at an inability or disinclination to make any serious moves towards a woman. This struggle continued throughout years of unsuccessful dating and pretending. When I eventually decided to act on my desires, the guilt and the shame, as well as the drinking, increased. Now I had to hide not only my thoughts, but also my conduct. I always tried to project the image of the conservative, masculine, deep-voiced loner with the mysterious, possibly tragic, but always heterosexual love affair in the past. I wound up living two separate and distinct lives, that of the gay man with friends and interests to match and that of the straight man with a totally separate set of friends and interests. I had to walk this tightrope while trying to build a solid professional life as well. After college, I had gone on to law school, where drinking on a daily basis became the norm. I justified myself with the thought that a few drinks helped me to relax and focus on my studies. Somehow, I managed to do well in law school and to land several prestigious legal positions afterward. I soon learned that I could not drink during the day. If I had even one drink at lunch, the rest of the afternoon would be lost. Instead, I postponed my drinking until immediately after work and would then make up for lost time. Work in a law firm added a third side to my already divided life. Now I had to try to maintain social relations with clients, members, and associates of the firm, in addition to my gay and straight friends from my private lives. Needless to say, the drinking increased. Things became ever more confused. Eventually, the pressures became too great. I had formed a serious relationship and decided that I could no longer carry on the deception. Instead, I would change careers and go into teaching. For a while, things seemed to be going well, but the slide toward active alcoholism was slowly accelerating. I had had my first blackout several years before. At that time, I told myself if it ever happened again, I would stop drinking. It happened again, and again, and again, but I didn't stop. I was always able to come up with some explanation, excuse, or rationalization that justified my continued drinking. In time, personality changes began to occur with regularity when I drank. I had always had a sharp tongue. When drinking, I frequently became vitriolic. At other times, I could be charming and affectionate. Sometimes too much so. People never knew just what I would do or say. After a few years, I was a nightly blackout drinker. My lover drank heavily as well, and I began to compare my drinking with his. I argued to myself that I could not have a problem because his drinking was worse than mine at times. In fact, I suggested that he might try AA. When he did try this fellowship, I did all I could do to undermine his efforts to get sober. His recovery would present an obvious, if unacknowledged, threat to my drinking. Eventually, the stress became too much and we broke up, but not before I had succeeded in undermining his recovery. The slide continued. Most of my friends were unwilling to put up with my conduct, the verbal and sometimes physical abuse, the midnight phone calls, the forgotten invitations, and the selfish disregard of anything but my own need to drink. Those few friends who did not withdraw were forced away by my resentments and increasing paranoia. I cut people out of my life, refusing to return phone calls and ignoring them when we met by chance. By the end of my drinking, only two people were willing to have anything to do with me on a social basis, and both were heavy drinkers who were not surprised by my actions. The cases in which disaster struck when I drank outside my home increased. I made inappropriate passes at parties or at people at work, both men and women. At other times, I awakened battered or with my watch or wallet missing, or in the company of strangers whose names I did not remember and did not want to know. There were inevitable injuries and accidents. I was ejected from bars because I would steal tips or change from bartenders or other customers to pay for the drinks I could no longer afford. At other times, I would get into arguments and be forced to leave. In consequence, I made the seemingly logical decision not to drink outside the house. Instead, most of my drinking was now solitary. When I left work, I would have a few stiff drinks at a diner and then go home. I would stop off at the kitchen to pick up a glass, some ice, and some mixer. I would go to my bedroom where I kept half-gallon bottles of gin and vodka and read while the ice melted. The mixer ran out and sometimes the glass broke. Every night was blackout drinking. The really bad times were when I would have to struggle outside to a liquor store or a bar late at night, weaving and trying not to stagger, because I had miscalculated and run out of alcohol. I found it increasingly difficult to do anything more than work and drink. I was afraid to use public transportation or even to walk on the streets. My stomach was constantly upset, and my doctor had diagnosed a number of intestinal disorders. Even though I rarely drank away from home, my body was covered with bruises because I often fell down during blackouts. I never wore short-sleeved shirts, even in summer, because people would ask me about the bruises. One morning, I woke up with a numb leg and found that I had somehow ruptured two spinal discs while in a blackout at home. For the last 4 years, I lived alone in a small house. The ceiling of one room had collapsed, and plaster dust was everywhere, coating the garbage and newspapers that littered the floor. Empty food cartons, beer cans, bottles, and dirty clothes lay where they were tossed. I had gotten a cat because the mice were out of control, but I was not conscientious about cleaning up after the cat. It is not surprising that I had few visitors and neighbors tended to avoid me. The last few months were filled with fear and self-pity. I began to contemplate suicide with increasing regularity, yet I was afraid of dying. I remember thinking that this life would go on and on, never getting better and slowly fading away to nothing. Then I began to hear the whispers. I became convinced that there were people living in my house. I couldn't see them, except for occasional glimpses out of the corner of my eyes. And so I concluded that they were small and somehow living in the walls or under the stairs. I could hear them plotting to kill me. There were nights when I went to bed with a knife in hand to protect myself. Other nights I locked myself in the bathroom so they couldn't get me. One night I left a shot of vodka on the mantelpiece so they would go after that and leave me alone. Then a miracle occurred. An evening came when I decided to have one drink outside and then go straight home. I had that drink and left for my house. The next thing I remember is waking up the next morning with a stranger I had picked up in a bar. Apparently, I had gone on autopilot and, in a blackout resulting from just one drink, had gone on a tear. The look of disgust and pity on the face of that stranger was the jolt I needed. I suddenly realized that my life was totally insane, that my drinking was out of control, and that I was either an alcoholic or a candidate for committal to the local asylum. Not wanting to be locked up, I decided to try Alcoholics Anonymous. I called my former lover, and he put me in contact with an individual who took me to my first meeting. Although I can barely recall anything about that meeting, I heard two things I have never forgotten. The first was, "You don't have to drink again." This was a total revelation to me. For a long time, I believed that alcohol was one of the few positive things left in my life. I looked forward to my first drink every evening and thought that alcohol was holding my life together. I had to drink to survive, let alone to have any comfort. Yet here, people who had been in the same boat were telling me I didn't have to drink. I don't think I believed them that night, but it gave me enough hope to avoid drinking the rest of the day. The second thing I heard was, "You don't have to be alone anymore." This too was a revelation. For years, I had rejected or been rejected by friends, lovers, family, and God. I was alone and afraid. My life had narrowed to work and the bottle, and work remained in the picture only because it was a necessity to enable me to buy the bottle. The isolation and loneliness that alcoholism brought weighed heavily on me, and those words lifted an immense burden of fear. Again, I'm not sure that I completely believed, but I felt hope for the first time in years. I did not fall in love with AA at first glance. The man who took me to my first meeting later became my first sponsor, and he had to put up with objections, arguments, questions, and doubts, everything a trained but very muddled legal mind could throw at him. He was gentle with me. He did not push his opinions on me. He had the sense to see that I was so afraid and so used to being alone that I could not face a hard shell approach. He listened to my questions, answered some, and suggested that I could best answer others myself. He refused to argue, but was willing to explain and share his own experiences. I had asked him to be my sponsor before. I knew what he did for a living, and I felt I could not back out of the relationship when I discovered he was a minister. My alcoholism and my lifestyle had led me to reject the religion and the God of my upbringing. I had never replaced them. Instead, I was an agnostic, doubting the existence of God, but afraid to say so in case I was wrong. My self-pity and sense of victimization led me to doubt that a caring God could exist. If he did, why had he given me so many problems? I was very wary of the members who talked of their spiritual lives. My sponsor was a living damper on my intolerance, but even more, he told me that it would be all right for me to doubt God, that AA was not a religious program, and to belong, I did not have to adhere to any set of beliefs. He suggested that for me, a good starting point would simply be recognition of the fact that I had failed in running the world. In short, acceptance of the fact that I was not God. He also suggested that I might try occasionally to act as if I believed. Somewhere, I had heard that it is easier to act yourself into a new way of thinking than to think yourself into a new way of acting. And this made sense in the context of acting as if. I also thought that the people in the meeting sometimes seemed too standoffish and overly concerned with their friends and acquaintances rather than with me, the newcomer. Well, on my way toward developing a resentment, I expressed this to my sponsor. He suggested I might find people more communicative if I look at the coffee-making commitment for the group I had joined. Although I thought I was far too special to make coffee, I did figure that as coffee maker, I would have the chance to select decent cookies, and so I agreed. My sponsor was right again. People did start to speak to me, if only to complain about the coffee and cookies. But once a conversation starts, communication frequently continues. I started to work on the steps, and even with my difficulty over the third step and the God concept, I began to develop a sense of trust in the AA group and in the ideals of the fellowship as manifestation of a power greater than myself. although for many years I did not come to an acceptance of God who intervened personally and directly in the lives of individuals, I was able to accept the idea of a force that moved in the rooms and animated AA members with a sense of unconditional love. That satisfied my spiritual needs for a long time. A later sponsor took me through the steps 8 and 9 and provided me with support during some trying times. In my third year of sobriety, I was bedridden for over a month as a result of that earlier injury to my spinal disc. My father died, a relationship ended, and the AIDS epidemic started to hit home among my friends and acquaintances. Over the course of that and the next few years, almost half of my gay friends died. I learned in that year that if I ask for help, my higher power will never give me anything I can't handle. It was in this period that I started to turn to service beyond the group level. I had helped in the founding of the first gay AA group in my part of town and was elected general service representative after having served in other group offices. I knew nothing of general service at that time, and I decided to learn what it was all about so I could do a decent job and be able to pass it on to a successor as quickly as possible. After 2 years, I went on to do a number of other service jobs for AA. In all these positions, I never felt obligated to conceal or deny my sexuality. I have always felt that the representatives of groups in my area were concerned only with how we carried the message of recovery, not with what I might do in my personal life. When I first came to this fellowship, I had lost my health and sanity, my friends, much of my family, my self-respect, and my God. In the years since, all of these have been restored to me. I no longer have the sense of impending doom. I no longer wish for death or stare at myself in the mirror with loathing. I have come to terms with my higher power. After more than a dozen years in the AA fellowship, I was able to join a religious group and have now become active in that organization. I have a full, happy life with friends and loving family. Recently, I retired and have begun to travel throughout the world. I have attended and felt welcome at AA meetings wherever I have gone, inside and outside the United States. Even more important, I have returned to my home group and am still asked to make coffee. I now have an extended family that is international in scope, all the members of which are joined by bonds of shared pain and joy. And so ends the story of Tightrope. So we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and just want to remind you, you're listening to KRFP 90.3, the coolest station in the nation. And here's a little Dave Mason, a little blast from the past. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. That was a little Dave Mason for you, one of my favorite acts from the 70s. And now we're going to go on with the second story, which is number 11 in the back of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's titled Flooded with Feeling. When a barrier to God collapsed, this self-described agnostic was at step three. When I first came to AA, I thought everyone had drunk more than I had, that everybody had gotten into more trouble. But I kept coming to meetings, and after a while, I began to hear the beginnings of their stories. I came to realize that I was on the same road. I just hadn't gone as far yet. I had my first drink in my senior year of high school. That first night, I slipped out the window so my parents wouldn't hear me leave. There were four of us, and we only brought four bottles of home brew. I never made that mistake again. The next week, a bunch of us went camping, and we bought cases of beer. We finished it all. The others drank a lot, too, but I was the only one who woke up in the middle of the night and started wandering around the countryside by the light of the moon. I was the one who walked for miles searching for something. I know now what I was looking for. Unlike the rest of them, I wanted another drink. I had a great time that summer between high school and college. It revolved around drinking. Drinking and football, drinking and hunting, drinking and playing pool, drinking and driving. Nothing really bad happened, but it could have. I nearly got arrested. A friend just missed being shot. The car I was riding in stopped just before it crashed. I don't think most moderate social drinkers remember so clearly the night they had their first drink. I'm sure that very few of them make the date into an annual celebration by getting drunk as possible. It was in my second year of drinking that I started saying that if you can still feel your face, you're not drunk enough. In my third year, I drank homemade peach wine, and when it was gone, I had some whiskey. That night, I vomited in a blackout. Soon, I found that I didn't get as sick on vodka. Drinking vodka was like something out of science fiction. I could be someplace one moment and instantly be transported to somewhere else the next. I could never seem to find that happy balance. I remember going to a party. I started drinking, and suddenly I could talk to anybody. I was having a lot of fun, but I kept on drinking. Soon I could barely walk. A friend drove me home that night, but I sometimes drove a car when I was too drunk to walk. I became a teacher and didn't drink too often for a while. Then I did drink. When I did drink, I almost always got drunk. The teachers would get together a couple of times a year for a poker party. I usually didn't drink anything. One time I did, and I made a fool of myself. I decided that drinking just wasn't fun anymore. I quit. My cure for drinking was isolation. I would get up, go to work, come home, watch TV, and go to bed. It got to the point where I couldn't remember anything good that had ever happened. I couldn't imagine anything good ever happening in the future. Life had shrunk down to an endless, awful now. The depression became so bad that only medical treatment kept me from killing myself. After 7 months, the doctor took me off the medication. I wasn't suicidal, but I wasn't very happy either. A new teacher came to my school, and I invited myself over to her place for a drink. I remember telling her as I lifted the glass that this might not be such a great idea, but I believe it's worth the risk. As casually as that, I began drinking again. At the winter break, she went to visit her boyfriend, and I was alone again. 2 days before Christmas, I went to a party. I wasn't going to drink because I had driven there, and I knew that drinking and driving was a bad idea for me. I wasn't feeling particularly good or bad, just a little uncomfortable because I didn't know most of the people there. I was sitting on the couch 1 minute and up drinking a glass of wine the next. There was no conscious premeditation at all. This is the point when many people say, "And I went on drinking for 10 more years." Instead, an odd thing happened. A few days later, a teacher came up to me at work and said that she was an alcoholic and that she was going to an AA. She had never seen me drink, so I don't know what made her do that. The next day, I asked her how often she went to meetings. "Once a week?" I asked. "No," she said, that she had been going nearly every day for almost 6 months. That seemed a little extreme, but I thought that maybe if I went to a meeting with her, it might help her out. Besides, I was lonely. Halfway through the meeting, I had the strangest idea. People were introducing themselves as alcoholics, and I had the urge to do the same. This was peculiar because I wasn't, of course. Later, my friend asked me what I thought of the meeting. I said that I really didn't know. It was only much later I realized that for the first time in years, I felt that I belonged. The next day, we went to another meeting, and this time I did say I was an alcoholic. I went to the third meeting by myself. I was nervous. I felt as if I were about to jump out of my skin. I did something that was amazing to me. Before the meeting, I stuck out my hand and introduced myself as a newcomer. I had someone to talk to. I calmed down. From time to time, I would tell the truth. I said in the meeting that I was afraid to get a sponsor because I was afraid he might ask me to do something. I left that meeting with a phone number. I called it, and sure enough, my new sponsor started leading me through the steps using the big book. I called him every day. I told him that I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. He said it didn't matter what I wanted. The question I had to answer for myself was whether I was or I wasn't. He even suggested that I could try a little controlled drinking if I wasn't sure. I knew I had never been able to do that. I didn't have to do any more research. All I really had to do was review the drinking I had already done. I remember telling a friend years ago that I didn't have a drinking problem. I had a stopping problem. We laughed. It was true, but there was something else going on, something that had never occurred to me until I came to AA. I didn't just have a stopping problem, I had a starting problem too. No matter how often I stopped or for how long, I always started drinking again. After not drinking for 3 months, I was on the phone with the friend who had taken me to that first meeting. I was complaining to her about problems at work and how my sponsor didn't understand me. Later in the conversation, I mentioned that even when I described myself as agnostic, I thought maybe something was watching out for me. She asked, "Isn't it about time you made a decision?" I knew where to look in the big book, and I had been careful to avoid it until then. I turned to the third step prayer and quietly read it to her over the phone. Nothing happened. I didn't expect anything to happen. Then, for some reason, I turned back to the words, "No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles." They echoed in my mind. Something happened. A barrier collapsed. Without moving or speaking, I was carried away on a flood of emotion. Yet, at the same time, I was completely aware of myself and my surroundings. I could hear my friend's voice asking what had happened to me. I couldn't answer. I still can't explain it. I know that I took the third step, turning my will and my life over to a higher power, that night because I began writing a four-step inventory the next day, and I continued to write until I did the fifth step with my sponsor. Soon, I had a list of people I had harmed. I talked about each of the amends with my sponsor. By the time I had started setting things right with my family, I began to feel a lot better. More than 11 years later, it's hard to recapture the feeling of that night. What do I believe as a result? I can say that doubting God's existence was no barrier at all to a spiritual experience. Also, I can say that having such an experience didn't lead me to any certainty about God. Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the freedom to believe and to doubt as much as I need to. I do not know that my life is different now. I haven't had a drink since I came to AA. I have fewer resentments, and I don't spend much time thinking about the past. I have found that my experience can be of help to other people. I have come to believe that hard times are not just meaningless sufferings, and that something good might turn up at any moment. That's a big change for someone who used to come into the morning feeling sentenced to another day of life. When I wake up today, there are lots of possibilities, and I can hardly wait to see what's going to happen next. I keep coming back because it works. And that's the end of that story, and that's about the end of our time today. Just going to remind you one more time that there's going to be New Year's Eve Sober Extravaganza. It's going to be at St. Mark's Episcopal, and that's going to be on Saturday, the 31st, of course, New Year's Eve. You're all invited, so come on down, check it out, and I want you all to have a wonderful New Year's Eve. If you don't make it, stay safe, and we'll be talking to you in the next year. And that's it for us. And I'm going to remind you all that if you think you have a problem with drugs and alcohol or mental health disorders, you do.
Show me all the things, what else can see? So record. But I know no matter what the waitress brings, I should drink it and always be thought. Yeah, I will drink it and always be.